The next sensory experience I want to discuss is the experience of touch. It turns out that our skin is a very active organ biologically. It is alive, it breathes, it gets rid of toxins, and it self-repairs. But most importantly, what scientists are finding out is that the skin is the richest source of both hormones and also of immune cells. Now, a whole new range of therapies may emerge because of the fact that the skin is one of the richest sources of all the hormones that we can find in the brain, in the hypothalamus, anywhere in the body, we can also find them in the skin. So when we stimulate the skin, we can cause literally a shower of healing chemicals into our bloodstream. One of the most important of these are growth factors or growth hormones. Now, if our skin is the richest source of growth factors, then we could cause these growth factors to be released into our bloodstream by simply stimulating the skin. Like the other organs, it is also a seat of emotions. When we refer to emotions very frequently, we call them feelings. When we are deeply moved, we say we were touched. We describe situations as sticky or ticklish or thorny. These expressions all have to do with sensations in our body. Therefore, the experience of touch or sensation linked to a thought is really what an emotion is. Once again, we can influence emotions and feelings and desires through our skin as a result of the release of these hormones. When rats, for example, rat mothers lick their puppies, growth hormone levels in the puppies go up. When dogs lick their puppies, growth hormone levels go up. There's a condition in children called psychosocial dwarfism, where the children don't grow and their growth hormone levels are very depressed. If you give them injections of growth hormone, nothing happens. But if you touch them and stroke them and cuddle them, then growth hormone levels go up as well. So one of the things we recommend to all our patients is that they give themselves a daily massage. And it's very simple. All they have to do is take, again, we use sesame oil. The reason we use sesame oil, because most research has been done on sesame oil. If you rub sesame oil between your toes, you'll never get athlete's foot. If you rub it in your hair, you'll never get seborrhea or dandruff. If you rub it over your skin, you never get seborrheic dermatitis. And in fact, it's extremely useful for early psoriasis. If you swish your mouth with it, your taste buds get much more lively. So sesame oil has some unique properties. It's also bacteriostatic in that it doesn't allow bacteria to grow. It also never gets rancid, and it also gets absorbed through the skin. So we recommend taking some warm sesame oil, maybe 4 or 5 tablespoons full, and gently doing a total body massage. You can start with your head, then rub it in your face, and then rub your chest with it in gentle strokes. Rub it over your abdomen, rub it over your extremities, moving circularly over the joints. And the whole procedure takes about 5-6 minutes. And then following that, you take a shower. But you do it every day. And even if you do it for 2 or 3 days, or even if you do it once, you'll notice a different sense of energy and buoyancy that you haven't experienced before. And why does it come about? It comes about as a result of the release of these growth factors and growth hormones into the bloodstream. We are now in the process of doing a study, but there's early evidence that in post-coronary patients, patients who've had heart attacks, if after the heart attacks they receive massage in the coronary care unit, they can cause a release of growth factors into their bloodstream, which will open up coronary vessels and also open up collateral blood vessels, increasing the blood supply to the heart. Now, if you had a drug that did that, of course, it would immediately generate millions of dollars in sales. But you can cause the same release of these growth factors through your skin by giving yourself a massage. It doesn't have to be vigorous. We recommend that you use the oil because the oil gets absorbed and then actually causes physiological changes outside. But even if you don't use the oil, it makes a big difference. Just rubbing the sesame oil from head to toe, different parts of the body, for 5 minutes before you take a shower, and then you feel that sense of energy and buoyancy throughout the day. In Ayurveda, there are certain points in the body that are called marma points. These are junction points between consciousness and physiology. For example, the place between the eyebrows is a marma point. If you gently massage that with oil, then that will bring about a state of calm, restful alertness and will bring about certain changes in physiology also. If you massage the soles of the feet, that will induce sleep. In fact, if you have a cranky child who is very irritable, all you have to do is gently massage the soles of the feet with warm sesame oil. And as you're doing it, the child will fall asleep because it stimulates the sleep center in the brain. If you massage the area overlying the heart, that's another marma point, that has a very important effect on emotions such as anger and impatience. If you massage the area over your stomach, that influences your appetite, gets rid of false cravings. These different points are known as marma points, and they are very effective in bringing about certain changes in our physiology. The skin is the largest organ of our body. It weighs about 6 to 10 pounds, and it's about 16% of our body weight. One of the most important things to realize is that touch is about 10 times stronger than verbal or emotional contact. So touch is a very effective communicator. When you want to communicate with somebody, if you touch them and there's some caring implied in the touch, that is a much more potent communicator than words. Of course, Vata people respond even more dramatically to that than others. So, in summary, I'd like to say that just like there's a minimum daily requirement of any sensory input, there's a minimum daily requirement of the experience of touch. And we shouldn't be afraid of touching each other. We shouldn't be afraid of expressing our emotions and our feelings in relationship through the experience of touch. Because touch has a very much more powerful influence on our physiology than any of the other sensory inputs. So through the five senses, we can see how we can influence this internal pharmacy that exists in us. And with the use of this internal pharmacy, we can improve the immune functioning of the body, we can improve our memory, we can improve our attention span, our learning abilities, improve our sensory experience, make it much more vital, make it much more vibrant, make it much more alive. And when that sense of aliveness comes into our physiologies, then we feel healthy. Because health is not just the absence of a disease, it's a joyfulness that should be inside us all the time. It's a state of positive well-being, which is not only physical, but emotional, and ultimately even psychological and spiritual. And when we feel like that, when we feel one with everything, we feel that lightness and buoyancy inside us, then we experience that state of dynamic non-change in the midst of change. And that's what balance is. It's flexibility again in the midst of change. The more flexible we are, the more adaptable we are, the more creative we become, and the better we are able to function in life. I would like to mention a few things about the Ayurvedic approach to the treatment of any addiction. The Ayurvedic approach doesn't force things on you. It gently allows your body to choose what is best for it. Because in fact, the body is always making the right decisions. Sometimes we override those decisions by not paying attention to the decisions that the body has made. And the key ingredient to the treatment of any addiction is to culture the value of what I call silent witnessing. Silent witnessing means observing without judgment, observing without evaluation, observing without analysis. So we get rid of labels, definitions, descriptions, analyses, evaluation, interpretation, or judgment. We just simply observe. And when we do that, then spontaneously changes come about. Let me give you a technique, for example, for somebody who would like to stop smoking cigarettes. The first thing I would tell such a person is, do not try to give up smoking. Hard-minded determination just sets you up for failure. Nicotine is addictive, as is the habit of reaching for a cigarette. To end these habits, you have to retrain yourself as unconsciously as you started. So what would I tell a patient who's trying to give up smoking? I'd say, keep your cigarettes with you. The strategy of throwing away cigarettes seems to make sense, but it only leads to panicked trips for more and the embarrassment of begging them from friends and strangers. Notice the automatic cues that make you reach for a cigarette and dissociate yourself from them. This point is very important. Most people light up automatically on cue. For some, the cue is picking up the phone. For others, it's turning on the television or starting a conversation or ending a meal or having a cup of coffee. So you probably know the cues that you are used to. And what you should do is just dissociate the act of smoking from these usual cues. So if you feel like smoking, go outside, sit down by yourself, and just like when we were eating, don't do anything else, just smoke the cigarette. Don't be speaking on the phone, don't be drinking a cup of coffee, don't be doing anything that you usually do when you smoke. And before you start, just gently put your awareness in your whole body. Ask your body if it wants the cigarette. And the body will usually recoil even at the idea. You ask your lungs, do you want to smoke? And usually the lungs will make a sound. Something like that. As soon as you ask your body that. But even though you ask your body and the lungs reject it, and you really want to smoke because you're addicted to the memory of the experience, then go ahead and smoke the cigarette, but do it consciously. Be just aware of all the sensations that are occurring in your body, in your throat, in your lungs, in your body. Don't evaluate those sensations. Don't judge them. Don't interpret them. Just be aware of them. And if you do this every time you're going to smoke, then slowly you'll see that the body keeps rejecting this cigarette smoke. And after a while, you'll notice, even immediately you'll notice, that your smoking habit decreases from, say, 2 packs a day to 5 or 6 cigarettes a day. And as you continue practicing awareness, non-evaluative awareness, with the act of smoking, gradually the body completely rejects the cigarettes and you lose your desire. That's the way to get rid of addiction, to lose the desire spontaneously. All the simple addictions that people have can be handled in the same way. We do not fight a temptation. The easiest way to avoid a temptation is to give in to it. There's some truth to that. Give in to it, but do it consciously and do it with full awareness. Do it non-judgmentally. Be aware of the sensations in your body as you do it. And every time you do it, the body will send out signals of comfort or discomfort. And you will slowly start responding to those signals, effortlessly lose your desire, which is the key thing. Silent witnessing is the key element here. What you're doing is you stop behaving like a bundle of conditioned reflexes that's constantly being triggered by people and circumstances and situations and things. Instead, for the first time in your life, you begin to act instead of reacting all the time. The ability to act instead of reacting all the time comes from the ability to stand back and become a silent witness of the whole process. And there's no evaluation in that witnessing. It's just a simple observation of the process. Why does anyone do anything? I'm asking you a very simple question. And the reason is that they believe that it will give them pleasure or happiness. So ultimately, the only reason for anyone to do anything is that they want to experience either a pleasurable sensation or they want to experience happiness. Happiness is the goal of all goals. And an addiction is nothing other than the linking of a certain stimulus with the interpretation of happiness or pleasure. But you've done it unconsciously in the past, and then you're stuck with it. How do you change it? You dissociate the link between the experience of pleasure and the stimulus. And how can you do it? By replacing the experience of pleasure with the stronger experience of pleasure. So what we do for these hardcore addictions in our clinics is we really bathe them in the experience of pleasure through the five senses. We give them luxurious oil massages every day, long ones. We teach them how to meditate. We teach them music therapy, aromatherapy. We just saturate the senses with the experience of pleasure. They become so used to that that they don't want to disrupt it in any case, under any circumstance. They don't want that experience to be overshadowed by any other experience. It's a method of first uncoupling the memory with the pleasure and then replacing the pleasure with another memory. So next time they reach out for that cocaine or heroin, spontaneously the memory of pleasure comes that they have experienced before through other things, and they resort to those other things. Ultimately, your body is just the place your memories call home. Memories create the physical body. Memories continuously reincarnate themselves as the physical body. Your taste buds change every 6 weeks, but they don't forget the difference between sweet, sour, and salt. Your skin cells change every month. They don't forget the difference between hot and cold. Your DNA changes every 6 weeks. It remembers the entire evolutionary history of mankind. So memory is quantum mechanical. It's non-material, and yet it incarnates itself or expresses itself or manifests itself as the physical expression of the cell. When I see a lung cancer on an X-ray and compare it with, say, a lung cancer from 3 months ago, am I actually seeing the same cancer? No, because the raw material that makes up this cancer is completely different from the raw material that made up the cancer 3 months ago. I can get rid of it, I can bomb it with chemotherapy or radiation, or take it out with surgery, but unless I influence the quantum fluctuations that make up the memories of that cancer, I'm not really going to cure it. So if I want to cure a disease, I have to change the cellular memory of the disease. And that doesn't come by manipulating emotions. It comes by, in fact, transcending the emotions, transcending all thought, and becoming the silent witness of the process. Having dealt with the whole notion that the physical body is a result of fluctuations of conditioned responses based on previous memories, I think the key to curing an illness is to get rid of the memory of the illness at a cellular level. Recently, there have been some very interesting articles in the medical literature. For example, an article just appeared in Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal, which says that heart disease is reversible. Now, this would be completely alien to our old concept of the body. If you have a blocked artery, the only way you can get rid of it is to bypass it surgically or use a drug to open up the artery. But this study, which just came out, studied a number of patients, 82% of whom improved in that their arteries actually opened up after 1 year of practicing certain lifestyle changes, such as going to a diet which was more compatible with vegetarian lifestyle, such as doing certain exercises and doing meditation. The introduction of meditation, exercise, and diet actually opened up the blood vessels. What is important about this is that it's showing us that nothing in the body is permanent. that even though we think of an artery as blocked and think of it in mechanical terms, actually we are recreating that blocked artery in every second of our existence. It's the memories that are doing that. Change the memories through certain changes in our life, and then the artery opens up. Also, the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California is compiling a list of what they call spontaneous regressions and remissions in cancer. They have a list of about 3,000 cases of cancer, well documented, where at one time the patient had cancer and now they don't have it. And what happened? Did they mood make, think themselves positive into that state of being? No. They had a deep insight that immediately switched the memory bank, and they replaced that memory with another memory. And that memory, that trigger, was what was responsible for the healing response. I'll tell you one very fascinating story about one patient of mine that is really amazing. I'll call the patient Bob. He's a young man, about 35 years old. And a few months ago, about 10 months ago, he was repairing an antenna on his roof. Actually, he was doing it for a neighbor. And he picked up a wire, which he thought was a dead wire, but it happened to be a live wire. And there were 12,000 volts of electricity in that wire. And these 12,000 volts of electricity immediately went through his body, and they would instantaneously kill anybody. They caused something called ventricular fibrillation. In fact, when people are electrocuted, that's the amount of voltage that is used. So he was electrocuted, and he must have died instantaneously. He fell from the roof, and it was about 30 feet distance, and he happened to land on the ground, miraculously, you might say, or coincidentally, or whatever word you might want to use. When he hit the ground, he hit it at the right impact on the right part of his chest, with just enough impact at the right angle to start another jolt of electricity that brought his heart back from ventricular fibrillation into a normal rhythm. In other words, you might say he died, technically, and then as he landed on the ground, technically he came back. He didn't have a functioning heart, now he has a functioning heart. In any case, the jolt of electricity that went through his body burnt his entire thigh, his right thigh, as it exited from the right knee. And they wanted to amputate his leg, but he was so grateful for this gift of life to nature, God, the universe, whatever you might say, that the moment he would recall the extraordinary circumstance of his gift, so to speak, he would experience in his body an exquisitely blissful sensation. Just the memory of his coming back, so to speak. And any time he experienced that and he put his attention on his lower extremity, he would experience some tingling over there. To make a long story short, in the course of 1 year, or little less than 1 year, he has regrown the muscles of his thigh that didn't exist there. He has literally created, out of that quantum mechanical field of energy and information, an entirely new limb. And how does he do it? He does it through a transformation in memory. It's just a shift in his consciousness. In this case, it happens to be spontaneous. Ultimately, therefore, the healing response is triggering something at very deep levels of awareness, those levels of awareness that are responsible even for cellular memories. You have to get rid of the cancer, then exorcise the ghost of the cancer. Now that sounds esoteric again, but by the ghost of the cancer, I just mean those quantum fluctuations in that field of energy that give rise to that physical expression of cancer. I had a patient with breast cancer who had metastases to different parts of her body. She came to the clinic, and what we did was replaced her experience of discomfort and pain and agony and fear, all of that, by the experience of pleasure, by the experience of love, by the experience of comfort in the body. And through all these techniques, through sensory stimulation, basically. a lot of massage therapy was also involved. Massage therapy is one of the most important aspects of this because it causes the shower of these chemicals into the body as well. Well, in any case, what happened was that within a few weeks, the pain that she was having disappeared. The discomfort disappeared, and the fear went. And as the fear went, she started feeling much better. She started moving around. And she couldn't even walk before that. She started going swimming. She called her doctor. She said, "Guess what? I'm feeling fine." And he said, "Well, let me examine you." He did some x-rays. And of course, the cancer was still there. So he said, "Don't worry. It's all in your mind. It will definitely come back." Now, as soon as she heard that, the fear came back. And with the fear, the pain came back. And with the pain, the cancer got worsened also. So here, if you understand the model correctly, you'll realize that a shift in awareness is the first change. This lady, by the way, has a happy ending because she again restructured her state of awareness, lost her fear, lost her agony, lost her anxiety, lost her sense of discomfort, and subsequently the cancer also disappeared over a period of time. She also learned transcendental meditation, which is a specific procedure to quieten the mind and then experience more abstract levels of thinking, and then finally to experience pure silence in the mind. When you experience pure silence in the mind, then the body becomes silent also. And in that field of silence, the healing is much more efficient. What you have to remember is, when there's disruption or imbalance, the change first occurs in awareness. You feel uncomfortable. You feel that sense of discomfort. So you go to a doctor, he examines you, he does all blood tests, everything, and he finds nothing. He says, "There's nothing wrong with you." Well, that's because he's entrenched in the superstition of materialism. Why did you go to the doctor? Because you were feeling uncomfortable. The change in the level of awareness always precedes the physical change. So too, when you get better, the sense of comfort and the loss of fear precede the change in the physical expression. And the key ingredient in getting well is that loss of fear. That loss of fear, that experience of comfort, that experience of pleasure with the body, the experience of wellness, just that feeling of wholeness, which is non-verbal but very strong, causes a shift in the quantum fluctuations that finally result in the physical expression of health. So if we want to change the printout, then we have to change the blueprint. And what's the blueprint? It's the interpretations that we've locked ourselves into as a result of conditioned responses. That's all it is. And once you become aware of the conditioned response, and you can witness it non-judgmentally, that's the first breakthrough you've made. So you don't need to manipulate it. You need to become its silent witness. In the mere observation of it is the beginning of its dissolution. One way of witnessing an emotion is to witness the physical component of the emotion. Uncouple it from its physical component. Let's say you're driving a car and somebody cuts you off, and your usual response is that you immediately get angry and you get upset and you get turbulent inside. And that happens day after day after day. These little incidents, of course, build up, and that is reflected in your physiology. All those adrenaline molecules, those cortisol molecules, all these angry molecules that are eating your stomach up. There's a saying that an ulcer is not what you ate, but what's eating you. So how to get rid of that emotion? Well, next time you have the emotion, witness the physical component of the emotion. Because any emotion has two components to it. There's a thought and there's a physical sensation. How do you uncouple the two? Just allow your awareness to settle down on the physical discomfort and be aware of the physical discomfort. And spontaneously, the anger dissipates. Normally, people just act out their emotions. They're not even aware of the physical discomfort till afterwards, when they have the headache, or they get palpitations, or they get heartburn or something. at that moment to allow your awareness to shift to the experience of the sensation in the body that accompanies the emotion allows for silent witnessing of the emotion itself. When he cuts you off and you feel angry, there's a component of that anger that expresses as, say, heartburn or a tension in the chest. Be aware of that tension. See it, feel it, and the emotion will dissipate. You're feeling the sensations in your body. You get angry, feel the sensations in the body, the anger dissipates. An emotion needs both components. It needs the thought, it needs the physical sensation. If one of them is missing, the emotion isn't there anymore. So let's talk about the aging process. Can we retard it? Can we perhaps even reverse it? Again, the answer is if we get rid of some preconceived notions that we have about aging. If we get rid of what psychologists call premature cognitive commitments. Let me give you some examples from experimental biology to show you what a premature cognitive commitment is. In India, when they train elephants, sometimes what they do is they take a baby elephant, they tie it with an iron chain to a big tree, and gradually they decrease the size of the chain, ultimately replace it with a flimsy rope. It just looks like the chain. And you can take that same elephant now that has grown up to be a big, huge animal. You can tie it with that flimsy rope to a Christmas tree. It could walk away from that, or walk away with the tree itself, or uproot the tree, or snap that rope with one movement, but it doesn't do all of that. It's made a commitment in its body-mind that it's in a prison. You have fish sometimes separated in glass tanks from each other, and the separation is a transparent glass partition. After a while, you can remove the partition, and you'll find that the fish will swim to the edge of their tank and then come back. They won't go into the other tank. Even though they could, as a result of their initial sensory experience, they've made a commitment in their body mind that that's as far as they can go. That's the limit of their universe. Another experiment was done about 25 years ago at Harvard Medical School, where a group of kittens were brought up in a room that had horizontal stripes. Another group of kittens were brought up in a room that had vertical stripes. When these kittens grew up to be wise old cats, one group of cats could see only a horizontal world. The other group of cats could see only a vertical world. So one group of cats would bump into furniture legs, not because they didn't believe in their existence, but because they didn't have the connections in their nervous system to either see a horizontal world or a vertical world. Now, this is a very important experiment in all the other experiments, because what it tells us is that our sensory experience, which is our view of the world and even of our body, is programmed. Our initial sensory experience structures in our nervous system in such a way that subsequently our perceptions just reinforce what we now hold to be true. So the expression usually is, seeing is believing. Well, physiologically speaking, it's the other way around. If you don't have a notion for it, if you don't have an idea that such and such exists, if you don't have a concept or at a primordial level a belief, then your nervous system won't even allow that to get inside your brain. Right now, most people can take in less than 1/1,000,000,000 of all the stimuli that are available to them. At any one point in time, their nervous system can take in less than 1/1,000,000,000 of the stimuli that are available to them. And which ones are those? The ones that reinforce what they think exists out there. If they don't think it exists out there, then their nervous system will just edit it out. In other words, our sensory experience edits out everything that we don't think exists. And it brings in everything that we think, at a deep level of awareness, exists. Well, what's the reality? The reality is infinite possibilities. It's infinite possibilities all coexisting at the same time. And we take that field of infinite possibilities and we structure a certain perceptual reality. Now, how does this apply to aging? Well, one of the things that is becoming very clear about the aging process is that what we consider normal aging may be a premature cognitive commitment. Just like those fish that got committed to a certain reality, we as a species get committed to a certain reality of aging. I'll give you some very interesting experiments that show that that's really true. About 20 years ago, a doctor from Harvard by the name of Dr. Leaf traveled around the world looking at populations where people have a different expression of aging, in that there are many more centenarians there. Brought back some very fascinating pictures. Old people, 100 years old, 110 years old, riding horseback, swimming in cold streams and snow-clad mountains, some of them even smoking cigarettes, etc. But definitely a different biological expression of aging. And he was asked, what's different about these people? What's really the crucial difference here? Is it their diet? Is it the weather? Is it their family history? And the conclusion that he came to, and other people have since come to, it wasn't any of those things. It was the societal expectation of what aging is supposed to mean, the collective mindset of these people. In these societies, it was the collective mindset that as you grow older, you grow better. As you grow older, you become wiser. As you grow older, you're given more responsibility. In other words, to grow old is to become glamorous. The definition of glamorous in these societies is the older person. Everybody envies them because they're in charge. As a result of that collective perception of aging, that collective mindset of aging, that translates into a different biological expression in their bodies. And then recently, Dr. Ellen Langer did a study, which is absolutely fascinating. She's a professor of psychology at Harvard, and she did a very fascinating study. What she did was she advertised in a newspaper that she wanted 100 people that were over the age of 70 to do a certain experiment. She was going to take these people out of Boston into a retreat where for 10 days or so they were going to play a certain game. And what was the game? Basically, it was let's pretend. And what were they going to pretend? They were going to pretend that they were living 30 years ago in the 1950s. The experiment was done in 1985. So they were going to pretend that they were living in the 50s. And they were going to be the person they were 20 years ago. Just be like the person they were 20 years ago. And she structured an environment that was compatible with the 50s. So Life magazine, the music, the fashions, the dresses, the photographs, all these were from the 50s. You'd have rock and roll music with Elvis Presley, and they were talking about it in the present tense. And then she measured things like physical strength, perception, cognition, taste, hearing, visual thresholds, and other biological markers like hand grip, bideltoid grip, finger length, weight, height. And she found that 10 days of this environment and this 10 days of this collective change in the perception of these people resulted in a reversal of biological aging by several years. Now, this is a published study from Harvard Medical School that shows that just the collective perception of people and their interpretation of what's happening to them actually causes physiological changes in their blood. Their hormone levels change. The physical, the length of their fingers increased. They grew in height. They could see better. They could hear better. In fact, all they had to do was just be themselves. The instruction was, let yourself be just who you were in 1959. They watched movies like Anatomy of a Murder, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. So everything was from that time. And they discussed Khrushchev and the politics with Fidel Castro and Bill Russell and Floyd Patterson were the big names in the news at that time. Just doing that changed everything. And then she brought them back to Boston, and within a few days, everything went back to where it started from. You know, there's a saying from the Ayurvedic tradition, which is really a very important saying, and that is the crux of what we are talking about. There's a saying from Adi Shankara, who used to be a great rishi, a great seer. He said, the only reason people grow old and die is that they see other people growing old and dying. And what we see, we become. What we see, we become. What we hear, we become. What we touch, we become. What we taste and smell, we become. Our bodies are the metabolic end products of our sensory experiences and our interpretation of those sensory experiences. So if we think, if we see some people doing certain things and we see that for long enough, that becomes a commitment to that reality. Men get naughty at 40 sometimes. Women get menopause in their 40s or 50s. People get osteoporosis when they grow 50 or 60. They get social security at such and such age. They retire at such and such age. Then they go to a community where everyone reinforces the old idea of getting old, an old folks home or a nursing home. These are commitments on a collective level to a reality that we create. Collectively created the reality of aging. So if you really want to understand the biology of aging, we have to reinterpret that reality, because that's what it is. It's an interpretation done at levels of awareness below our conscious threshold. Nevertheless, an interpretation. It's like those mice. They smelt camphor and they were given the immune stimulus. Then every time they smelt camphor, they interpreted that to mean stimulate the immune system. Every time we see old people, we see the whole collective idea of these expectations, we commit ourselves to that reality. The first thing to understand is that we can change those interpretations because we made them in the first place. And secondly, it's important that society change those interpretations because most people are victims of societal thinking. They are under what we can only call the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's a hypnosis. And you have to wake up from that hypnosis. You have to just get away from that hypnosis because that's what it is. Transcending, going beyond the senses, meditation and silence and solitude and being with yourself allow you to escape from that hypnosis. Because in the silent witnessing of the thought process, you recognize that you are not the thought, but the thinker of the thought. And the thinker of the thought has choices, can reinterpret things. And when enough of us do that, then we'll have a generation in the future where it will be automatic, where children will grow up with a different notion of aging, with a different notion of what it means to get old. So I think one of the first things we can do to change that premature commitment is to recognize, in fact, that it is a premature commitment. That's not what reality is all about. And secondly, to take the responsibility for ourselves to change that. And ultimately, if enough of us do that, then society will change. And that change in collective consciousness will create a new mindset, which will be part of this new paradigm that we're talking about. The thinker behind the thoughts is ageless. The thinker behind the thoughts is the field of all possibilities. We can think of reality as having three components. One is the particle, which is matter, then the wave fluctuation, which is the mind, and the wave is the particle. Particle is the wave. We know that even from physics. But then there's the third component, that's the field, from where this comes. And we are neither the wave nor the particle, but the field that generates both the waves and the particles. Think of an ocean, for example, and think of it having lots of waves. And then think of somebody photographing one wave and thinking that the photograph is the ocean. That's a frozen moment of attention. That's what the body is. But all those waves that come on the surface of the ocean up and down, that's what the mind is. But neither those waves up and down, changing all the time, nor the photograph are the reality. The reality is the ocean, which is always there. And it creates this mind form and then expresses itself as this body, etc. So once you get in touch with that level of awareness, where you are the field which generates both the waves and the particles, then you've gotten touch with that aspect of you which is beyond time. It's timeless, it's spaceless, but it's the source of both. It's the source of energy, it's the source of information, it's the source of matter, it's the source of space, and it's the source of time. It's one singularity from which everything is generated. And that singularity is your own true inner self, which is beyond thought, beyond feeling, beyond emotion, beyond body, beyond mind, and the source of all of those. It's timeless, spaceless, pure potentiality. And through desire, we make the reality. What is desire? Desire is pure potentiality, seeking manifestation. Inherent in having the desire are the entire mechanics for its fulfillment. Just like inherent in the seed is the entire mechanics of a tree. Inherent in having the desire, whether it's to get rid of a disease or whether it's to reverse the aging process, inherent in the desire are the mechanics for its fulfillment. But the desire has to be at a deep level of awareness, and it has to be in the state of simplicity. It has to be without premature cognitive commitments. We'll talk more about this as we go through the other factors that influence aging and ultimately what it means to be psychologically free. Because when you're psychologically free, when you experience that psychological freedom, then your body has no restrictions. It can do anything it wants. Having discussed, I think, the most important factor that influences biological aging, let's talk about a few other factors which also research shows have a very significant effect on how we age. The second factor I'd like to talk about is the role of exercise, because so much is written about exercise, so much is said about exercise. What does the research really show? The research shows that just because exercise is good for you, it doesn't mean that overdoing it is better. There's a lot of research now that shows that if you over-condition an athlete, they don't live as long as the normal population. In East Germany, for example, now they have deconditioning programs for Olympic athletes, because they find that those athletes who were over-conditioned have problems like cardiomyopathy, like hypertension, like arthritis, and so on. According to Ayurvedic principles, the most important thing about exercise is that it should be enjoyable. If you don't enjoy exercise, if it's a burden for you, if it's something that you really don't like doing, then in fact it could be harmful for you. The second important thing about exercise is that it should be regular. And the third important thing about exercise is it should not cause any strain on your physiology. So the best exercises, according to Ayurveda, are swimming, brisk walking, and yoga. And even if you do that 3 times a week, any one of these exercises, brisk walking and swimming are the 2 best aerobic exercises. Jogging usually causes problems with joints, and in women it has been shown to cause prolapse of the uterus and all kinds of other problems in the internal organs. So brisk walking and swimming are the two most efficient ways to exercise, and about 30 minutes three times a week is more than enough. It brings about the physiological changes that are necessary. Going beyond that doesn't improve the situation. However, if you enjoy exercise and you like to do it more than three times a week, more than 30 minutes, the enjoyment itself is very beneficial to you. The third factor that influences aging is nutrition. We've already discussed the principles of Ayurvedic nutrition. I think one more thing I should add, and that is that a lot of research has gone into the relationship of how much we eat and how we age. And in general, it is the feeling amongst researchers that most people eat too much. In fact, Dr. Roy Walford at UCLA has done some astonishing experiments with mice. He calls it undernutrition. Actually, it's just ideal nutrition, because again, we accept as a norm overnutrition. And he can extend the lifespan of mice almost five times their normal lifespan just by cutting down on their nutritional intake. So if we just follow the principles of Ayurvedic nutrition that we discussed previously, eating always to a level of comfort and not going beyond that, then we are doing all right. And also all the six tastes, that was very important. There's a lot of research also on the role of emotions and the biology of aging. I always come back to one very simple idea in Ayurveda, and that is essentially there are only two emotions. One is the experience of fear, and the other is the experience of love. Anything that you can think of as a negative emotion is a form of fear. Anxiety is a form of fear. Anger is a form of fear. Hostility is a form of fear. Resentment is an expression of fear. Greed, possessiveness, jealousy, these are all forms of fear. And the opposite of fear is the experience of love. And I think the essential difference between the two is the essential difference of the old paradigm versus the new paradigm, which we discussed in the previous session. Love is not a mere emotion, even though it can be experienced as an emotion. Love is the experiential knowledge of unity. It's the experience of connectedness with everything and everybody. In the Vedic tradition, of course, love has cosmic connotations, in that love is the experience of connectedness. Love between a man and a woman, love between a father and a child, a mother and a child, love between people in general, or love with nature, they're all expressions of that one unity that connects us all. So even though love can be experienced as an emotion, ultimately it is the truth which is really binding everything and everybody and running the galaxies and organizing the infinite intelligence of nature. And therefore, true love is ultimately an experience of a higher state of consciousness. When you give somebody attention without evaluation, without judgment, you're expressing true love. True love comes when we don't expect anything in return for what we give. And that can only come if you think or believe or see people as an extended form of yourself. And therefore, the essential difference, once again, between fear and love is that in fear one feels alienated, separated, isolated, different, fragmented from wholeness. And in love, one is just connected with everything and everybody. It's an experience of unity consciousness. The great poet Rabindranath Tagore from India, he said, love is the ultimate reality. It is the truth at the heart of all creation. And therefore, true love can only come through evolution into a higher state of consciousness. To me, one of the most important experiences is the experience of transcending. I practice transcendental meditation myself. I've done it for over 10 years. And with that experience of silence, one spontaneously feels connected with people, with things, with nature. We cannot manipulate our emotions, as I said earlier. But when we begin to silently witness them, then spontaneously there is a change that comes about. And that spontaneity is the most essential aspect of the experience of love also. Another factor that influences biological aging is the role of toxins in the body. These are now understood as free radical compounds. That's the technical name for them. And they are oxygen, singlet oxygen, that is oxygen as a single atom without the molecule, something called hydroxy radical, hydrogen peroxide, and another substance called lipid peroxide. It seems that these four toxins are the ultimate mediators of more or less all disease and even aging. These free radicals get generated as a result of stress or environmental pollution or eating the wrong kinds of food. And when they accumulate in the body, they cause aging and entropy. In fact, they are responsible for entropy even in the environment. For example, when meat putrefies, it's because of free radicals. When your car rusts, that's because of free radicals. When there are holes in the ozone layer, that's because of free radicals. When there are pesticides in food, they get converted to free radicals. So we can very safely say that in 1990, there's a good understanding of what the final expression of entropy or disorder in the body is due to. It's due to the generation of these free radicals. The ideal situation, of course, would be not to generate the free radicals. And that would be if we were living in an environment that didn't have any pollution, or if we were stress-free, or if our food was pure without any additives or preservatives or carcinogens, which are frequently present in food, then that would be the ideal situation. However, since that ideal situation is not present, there is a lot of research that shows that it is possible to remove these free radicals from the body through the use of what are known as free radical scavengers. Free radical scavengers are natural compounds, and they are basically vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, riboflavin, which is a whole category of B2 vitamins, and certain other compounds known as catechins. And the research also shows that if you take vitamins in the form of pills, even though they have the ability to scavenge the free radicals, they're not as effective as food that is rich in these same vitamins. Essentially, there's no difference between synthetic vitamins and so-called natural vitamins. Both are effective, but they're not as effective as the foods that are cooked or raw that contain those vitamins. And the foods that are extremely rich in these vitamins, in these free radical scavengers, are basically citrus fruits, also broccoli and spinach and the green leafy vegetables, and fruits in general. Fruits in general are very rich in free radical scavengers. Therefore, I always suggest to my patients that they should make at least 50 to 60% of their total intake of food in this category. Fruits and fresh vegetables, green leafy vegetables, should comprise at least 50% of the total intake of food. These are also foods that are very rich in their water content, and it's very useful to have that water content in food also, because 60 to 70% or more of our body is basically water. Other than that, there are also herbal compounds that are extremely rich in free radicals.